Four runs and four sleeps later, the sleep's broken, confused spirals of exhaustion broken by fractured snatches of rest, the brightest patch of pewter in the sky had shifted visibly to the east. Noon had become afternoon, and the long Cytherean day was becoming Darthi's enemy. She climbed trees regularly to look for signs of geometrical shapes informing the growth of the forest, and every time she did, she glanced at that brighter smear of cloud sliding down the sky and frowned. Darthi, assisted by her adapt shell, had come some 500 kilometers westward. Maxwell Montes was lost behind her now, in cloud and mist and haze, and behind the shoulder of the world. She was moving fast for someone creeping, climbing, and swinging through the jungle, although she was losing time because she hadn't turned the adapt shell loose to forage on its own since the swamp tiger. She needed it to support and knit her arm. The shell fused to itself across the front and made a seamless cast and sling, and for the pain suppressants it fed her, along with its pre-chewed pap. The bones were going to knit all wrong, of course, and when she got back, they'd have to grow her a new one, but that was pretty minor stuff. The shell filtered toxins and allergens out of the biologicals it ingested, reheaving some of the carbohydrates, protein, and fat to produce a bland, faintly sweet, nutrient-rich paste that was safe for Darthi's consumption. She sucked it from a tube as needed, squashing it between tongue and palate to soften it before swallowing each sticky, dull mouthful. Water was never a problem. At least, the problem was having too much of it, not any lack. This was Venus. Water squelched in every footstep across the jungle floor. It splashed on the adapt shell's head and infiltrated every cargo pocket. The only things that stayed dry were the ones that were treated to be hydrophobic, and the coating was starting to wear off some of those. Darthi's cocoon was permanently damp inside. Even her shell, which molded to her skin perfectly, felt alternately muggy or clammy, depending on how it was comping temperature. The adapt shell also filtered some of the fatigue toxins out of Darthi's system, but not enough. Sleep was sleep, and she wasn't getting enough of it. The landscape was becoming dreamy and strange. The forest never thinned, never gave way to another landscape, except the occasional swath of swampland. But now, occasionally, twisted fumaroles rose up through it, smoking towers of orange and ochre that sent wisps of steam drifting between scalded yellowed leaves. Darthi saw one of the geysers erupt. She noticed that over it, and where the spray would tend to blow, there was a hole in the canopy. But vines grew right up the knobby accreted limestone on the windward side. Five runs and five attempts at a sleep later, Darthi began to accept that she desperately, desperately wanted to go home. She wouldn't, of course. Her arm hurt less. That was a positive thing. Other than that, she was exhausted and damp and cold, and some kind of thick liver-colored leech kept trying to attach itself to the adapt shell's legs, a species new to science, probably, and Darthi didn't give a damn. Kraken tried to contact her every few hours. She didn't answer because she knew if she did, she would ask Kraken to come and get her, and then she'd never be able to look another living Cytherean in the face again. It wasn't like Venus had a big population. Darthi was going to prove herself or die trying. The settling from Zamin, though, she took at once. They chatted about swamp tigers. Zamin predictably was fascinated and told Darthi she'd write it up and give full credit to Darthi as observer. Tell hazards, too, Darthi said as an afterthought. Oh, yeah, Zamin replied. I guess it is at that. Dar, are you okay out there? Arm hurts, Darthi admitted. The drugs are working, though. I could use some sleep in a bed. A dry bed. Yeah, Zamin said. I bet you could. You know Kraken's beside herself, don't you? She'll know if I die, Darthy said. She's a good friend, Simine said. A good trick, making it about her rather than Kraken, or Darthy, or Kraken and Darthy. I worry about her. You know she's been unbelievably kind to me, generous, through some real roughness. She's generous, Darthy said. She's a genius and a charismatic. I know it better than most. Look, I should pay attention to where my feet are before I break the other arm. Then you will have to extract me, and won't I feel like an idiot then? Dar, she broke the sat. She felt funny about it for hours afterward, but at least when she crawled into her cocoon that rest period, adapt shell and all, she was so exhausted she slept. She woke up 16 hours and 12 minutes later, disoriented and sore in every joint. After 90 seconds, she recollected herself enough to figure out where she was, in her shell, in her cocoon, 50 meters up in the Ishtarian canopy, struggling out of an exhaustion and painkiller haze, and when she was, with a quick check of the time. She stowed and packed by rote, slithered down a strangler vine, stood in contemplation on the forest floor. Night was coming, the long night, and while she still had ample time to get back to base camp without calling for a pickup, every day now cut into her margin of safety. She ran. Rested, she almost had the resources to deal with it when Kraken spoke in her mind, so she gritted her teeth and said, "Yes, dear." "Hi," Kraken said. There was a pause in which Darthy sensed a roil of suppressed emotion. Thump, thump. As long as her feet kept running, nothing could catch her. That sharpness in her chest was just tight breath from running, she was sure. "Samin says she's worried about you." Darthy snorted. She had slept too much, but now that the kinks were starting to shake out of her body, she realized that the rest had done her good. "You know what Zamin wanted to talk to me about? You. How wonderful you are. How caring. How made of charm." Darthy sighed. "How often do people take you aside to gush about how wonderful I am?" "You might," Kraken said, "be surprised. It's hard being the partner of somebody so perfect. When did you ever struggle for anything? You have led a charmed life, Kraken, from birth to now." "Did I?" Kraken said. "I've been lucky, I don't deny. But I've worked hard and lived through things. You think I'm perfect because that's how you see me, in between bouts of hating everything I do. It's how everyone sees you. If status in the afterlife is determined by praises sung, yours is assured. I wish you could hear how they talk about you. People hold you in awe, love." Thump, thump, the rhythm of her foot soothed her when nothing else could. She was even getting resigned to the ceaseless damp, which collected between her toes, between her buttocks, behind her ears. "They love you. They tolerated me. No one ever saw what you saw in me." "I did," Kraken replied, "and quit acting as if I were somehow perfect. You've been quick enough to remind me on occasion of how I'm not. This thing, this need to prove yourself, it's a Sophic pathology, Dar. I love you, but this is not a healthy pattern of thought. Ambition is great, but you go beyond ambition. Nothing you do is ever good enough. You deny your own accomplishments and inflate those of everyone around you. You grew up in Aphrodite, and there are only 30,000 people on the whole damned planet. You can't be surprised that, brilliant as you are, some of us are just as smart and capable as you are." Thump, thump. She was watching ahead even as she was arguing, though her attention wasn't on it. That automatic caution was all that kept her from running off the edge of the world. Before her, below her, a great cliff dropped away. The trees in the valley soared up, but this was not a tangled jungle. It was a climax forest, a species of tree taller and more densely canopied than any Darty had seen. The light below those trees was thick and crepuscular, and though she could hear the rain drumming on their leaves, very little of it dripped through. Between them, until the foliage cut off her line of sight, Darty could see the familiar crescent-shaped roofs of Aboriginal Cytherean structures, some of them half consumed in the accretions from the forest of smoking stone towers that rose among the trees. She stood on the cliff edge overlooking the thing she had come half a world by airship and 1,000 kilometers on foot to find, and pebbles crumbled from beneath the toes of her adapt shell, and she raised a hand to her face as if Kraken were really speaking into a device in her ear canal instead of into the patterns of electricity in her brain. The cavernous ruin stretched farther than her eyes could see, even dark adapted once the shell made the transition for her. Even in this strange, open forest filled with colorful, flitting, flying things. Love? Yes, Kraken said, then went silent and waited. I'll call you back, Darty said. I just discovered the lost city of Ishtar. Darty walked among the ruins. It was not all she'd hoped. Well, it was more than she had hoped. She rappelled down, and as soon as her shell sank ankle-deep in the leaf litter, she was overcome by a hush of awe. She turned from the wet, lichen-heavy cliff, scuffed with the temporary marks of her feet, and craned back to stare up at the forest of geysers and fumaroles and trees that stretched west and south as far as she could see. The cliff behind her was basalt, another root of the volcano whose shield was lost in mists and trees. This was the clearest air she had ever seen. The trees were planted in rows, as perfectly arranged as pillars in some enormous fairy hall. The king of the giants lived here, and Darty was Jack, except she had climbed down the beanstalk for a change. The trunks were as big around as 10 men with linked hands, tall enough that their foliage vanished in the clouds overhead. Trees on Earth, Darty knew, were limited in height by capillary action. How high could they lift water to their thirsty leaves? Perhaps these Cytherean giants drank from the clouds as well as the soil. Oh, Darty said. And the spaces between the trees both hushed and elevated her voice, so it sounded clear and thin. Wait until Zamin sees these. Darty suddenly realized that if they were a new species, she would get to name them. They were so immense and dominated the light so completely that very little grew under them. Some native fern morphs, some mosses. Lichens shaggy on their enormous trunks and roots. Where one had fallen, a miniature Cytherean rainforest had sprung up in the admitted light, and here there was drumming, dripping rain, rain falling like strings of glass beads. It was a muddy little puddle of the real world, in this otherwise alien quiet. The trees stood like attentive gods, their faces so high above her she could not even hear the leaves rustle. Darty forced herself to turn away from the trees at last and began examining the structures. There were dozens of them, hundreds, sculpted out of the same translucent, mysterious, impervious material as all of the ruins in Aphrodite. But this was 6, 10 times the scale of any such ruin, maybe vaster. She needed a team. She needed a mapping expedition. She needed a base camp much closer to this. She needed to give the site a name. She needed to get back to work. She remembered then to start documenting. The structures, She could not say, of course, which were habitations, which served other purposes, or even if the aboriginals had used the same sorts of divisions of usage that human beings did, were of a variety of sizes and heights. They were all designed as arcs or crescents, however, singly, in series, or in several cases as a sort of stepped spectacular, with each lower, smaller level fitting inside the curve of a higher, larger one. Several had obvious access points open to the air, and Dorothy reminded herself sternly that going inside unprepared was not just a bad idea because of risk to herself, but because she might disturb the evidence. She clenched her good hand and stayed outside. Her shell had been recording, of course. Now she began to narrate and to sat link the files home. No fanfare, just an upload. Data and more data. And the soothing knowledge that while she was hogging her allocated bandwidth to send, nobody could call her to ask questions or congratulate or nobody except Kraken, with whom she was entangled for life. Hey, her partner said in her head. You found it. I found it, Dorothy said, pausing the narration but not the load. There was plenty of visual, olfactory, auditory, and kinesthetic data being sent even without her voice. How does it feel to be vindicated? She could hear the throb of Kraken's pride in her mental voice. She tried not to let it make her feel patronized. Kraken did not mean to sound parental, proprietary. That was Dorothy's own baggage. Vindicated? She looked back over her shoulder. The valley was quiet and dark. A fumarole, vented with a rushing hiss and a curve of wind, brought the scent of sulfur to sting her eyes. Famous? Famous? Hell, Terran famous. The homeworld is going to hear about this in, about 5 minutes, given light lag, unless somebody who's got an entangled partner back there shares sooner. You've just made the biggest Cytherean archaeological discovery in the past 100 days, love. And probably the next 100. You are not going to have much of a challenge getting allocations now. You worked hard for it. It feels like, Dorothy picked at the bridge of her nose with a thumbnail. The skin was peeling off in flakes. Too much time in her shell was wreaking havoc with the natural oil balance of her skin. It feels like I should be figuring out the next thing. The next thing, Kraken said. How about coming home to me? Have you proven yourself to yourself yet? Dorothy shrugged. She felt like a petulant child. She knew she was acting like one. How about to you? I never doubted you. You had nothing to prove to me. The self-sufficiency thing is your pathology, love, not mine. I love you as you are. Not because I think I can make you perfect. I just wish you could see your strengths as well as you see your flaws. 1 second, bit of a squall up ahead. Ah, I'm back. Are you on an airship? Was she coming here? Just an air jeep. Relief and a stab of disappointment. You wouldn't get from Aphrodite to Ishtar in an AJ. Well, Dorothy thought. Looks like I might be walking home. And when she got there? Well, she wasn't quite ready to ask Kraken for help yet. She would stay, she decided, 2 more sleeps. That would still give her time to get back to base camp before nightfall. And it wasn't as if her arm could get any more messed up between now and then. She was turning in a slow circle, contemplating where to sling her cocoon. The branches were really too high to be convenient, when the unmistakable low hum of an air car broke the rustling silence of the enormous trees. It dropped through the canopy, polished copper belly reflecting a lensed fisheye of forest, and settled down 10 meters from Dorothy. Smiling, frowning, biting her lip, she went to meet it. The upper half was black hydrophobic polymer. She'd gotten a lift in one just like it at Ishtar Base Camp before she set out. The hatch opened. In the cramped space within, Kraken sat behind the control board. She half rose, crouched under the low roof, came to the hatch, held out her right hand, reaching down to Darthy. Darthy looked at Kraken's hand, and Kraken sheepishly switched it for the other one, the left one, which Darthy could take without strain. "So I was going to take you to get your arm looked at," Kraken said. "You spent your allocations," Kraken shrugged. "Gonna send me away?" "This time," she said. "No." Kraken wiggled her fingers. Darthy took her hand, stepped up into the GEV, realized how exhausted she was as she settled back in a chair, and suddenly could not lift her head without the assistance of her shell. She wondered if she should have hugged Kraken. She realized that she was sad that Kraken hadn't tried to hug her, but, well, the shell was sort of in the way. Resuming her chair, Kraken fixed her eyes on the forward screen. "Hey, you did it." "Hey, I did." She wished she felt it. Maybe she was too tired. Maybe Kraken was right, and Darthy should see about working on that. Her eyes dragged shut, so heavy. The soft motion of the air car lulled her. Its soundproofing had degraded, but even the noise wouldn't be enough to keep her awake. Was this what safe felt like? Something else.
"I'm listening. If you don't mind, I was thinking of naming a tree after you."
"That's good," Kraken said.
"I was thinking of naming a kid after you."
Darthy grinned without opening her eyes. "We should use my Y chromosome. Color blindness on the X.
Y's are half atrophied already."
"We'll just use two X's," Kraken said decisively. "Maybe we'll get a tetrachromat."
Joe R. Lansdale. Prolific Texas writer Joe R. Lansdale has won the Edgar Award, the British Fantasy Award, the American Horror Award, the American Mystery Award, the International Crime Writers Award, and 6 Bram Stoker Awards. Although perhaps best known for horror thrillers such as The Night Runners, Bubba Hotep, The Bottoms, The God of the Razor, and The Drive-In, he also writes the popular Hap Collins and Leonard Pine mystery series, Savage Season, Mucho Mojo, The Two Bear Mambo, Bad Chili, Rumble Tumble, Captain's Outrageous, Devil Red, and Hyenas, as well as Western novels such as Texas Night Riders and Blood Dance, and totally unclassifiable cross-genre novels such as Zeppelin's West, The Magic Wagon, and Flaming London. His other novels include Dead in the West, The Big Blow, Sunset and Sawdust, Act of Love, Freezer Burn, Waltz of Shadows, The Drive-In 2, Not Just One of Them sequels, Leather Maiden, Deranged by Choice, and Edge of Dark Water. He has also contributed novels to series such as Batman and Tarzan. His many short stories have been collected in By Bizarre Hands, Tight Little Stitches in a Dead Man's Back, The Shadows, Kith and Kin, The Long Ones, Stories by Mama Lansdale's Youngest Boy, Bestsellers Guaranteed, On the Far Side of the Cadillac Desert with Dead Folks, Electric Gumbo, Rider of the Purple Rage, Fistful of Stories, Steppin' Out, Summer 68, Bumper Crop, The Good, the Bad, and the Indifferent, Selected Stories by Joe R. Lansdale, For a Few Stories More, Mad Dog Summer and Other Stories, The King and Other Stories, Dead Man's Road, An Omnibus, Flaming Zeppelins, The Adventures of Ned the Seal, Shadows West, with John L. Lansdale, Trapped in the Saturday Matinee, and High Cotton, the collected stories of Joe R. Lansdale. As editor, he has produced the anthologies The Best of the West, Retro Pulp Tales, Son of Retro Pulp Tales, Razored Saddles with Pat Labruto, Dark at Heart, All New Tales of Dark Suspense with wife Karen Lansdale, The Horror Hall of Fame, The Stoker Winners, the Robert E. Howard Tribute Anthology, Cross Plains Universe with Scott A. Kopp, Crucified Dreams, and the Urban Fantasy Anthology, edited with Peter S. Beagle. An anthology in tribute to Lansdale's work is Lords of the Razor. His most recent books are a new Happen Leonard novel, Dead Aim, The Thicket, The Ape Man's Brother, and a big retrospective collection, Bleeding Shadows. He lives with his family in Nacogdoches, Texas. Here, he sweeps us along with a man who is wrenched out of his proper place and time and thrown headlong into another world, one that proves even more dangerous than going down with the sinking Titanic.
The Wizard of the Trees by Joe R. Lansdale. Read for you by Michael Dorn. I am here because of a terrible headache. I know you will want more of an explanation than that, but I can't give it to you. I can only say I was almost killed when the great ship Titanic went down. There was an explosion, a boiler blowing, perhaps. I can't say. When the ship dove down and broke in half, I felt as if I broke in half with it. An object hit me in the head, underwater. I remember there was something down there with me. Not anyone on the ship, not a corpse, but something. I remember its face, if you can call it that. Full of teeth and eyes, big and luminous, lit up by a light from below. Then I was gasping water into my lungs, and this thing was pulling me toward a glowing pool of whirling illumination. It dragged me into warmth and into light, and my last sight of the thing was a flipping of its fish-like tail, and then my head exploded. Or so it seemed. When I awoke, I was lying in a warm, muddy mire, almost floating, almost sinking. I grabbed at some roots jutting out from the shoreline and pulled myself out of it. I lay there with my headache for a while, warming myself in the sunlight. Then the headache began to pass. I rolled over on my belly and looked at the pool of mud. It was a big pool. In fact, pool is incorrect. It was like a great lake of mud. I have no idea how I managed to be there, and that is the simple truth of it. I still don't know. It felt like a dream. With some difficulty, I had managed a bunk in steerage on the Titanic, heading back home to my country, the United States of America. I had played out my string in England, thought I might go back and journey out west, where I had punched cows and shot buffalo for the railroad. I had even killed a couple of men in self-defense, and dime novels had been written about me, the Black Rider of the Plains. But that was mostly lies. The only thing they got right was the color of my skin. I'm half black, half Cherokee. In the dime novels, I was described as mostly white, which is a serious lie. One look at me will tell you different. I was a rough rider with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, and when it arrived in England to perform, they went back, and I had stayed on. I liked it for a while, but as they say, there's no place like home. Not that I had really had one, but we're speaking generally here. I struggled to my feet and looked around. Besides the lake of mud, there were trees, and I do mean trees. They rose up tall and mighty all around the lake, and there didn't seem anything to do but to go among them. The mud I wouldn't go back into. I couldn't figure out what had happened to me, what had grabbed me and pulled me into that glowing whirlpool, but the idea of its laying a grip on me again was far less than inviting. It had hauled me here, wherever here was, and had retreated, left me, to my own devices. The mud I had ended up in was shallow, but I knew the rest of the lake wasn't. I knew this because, as I looked out over the vast mire, I saw a great beast moving in it. A lizard, I guess you'd call it. At least that was my first thought. Then I remembered the bones they had found out in Montana some years back, and how they were called dinosaurs. I had read a little about it, and that's what I thought when I saw this thing in the mud, rising up gray and green of skin, lurching up and dipping down, dripping mud that plopped bright in the sunlight. Down it went, out of sight, and up again, and when it came up a third time, it had a beast in its mouth, a kind of giant slick purple-skinned seal, its blood oozing like strawberry jam from between the monster's teeth. It may seem as if I'm nonchalant about all this, but the truth is, I'm telling this well after the fact and have had time to accept it. But let me jump ahead a bit. The world I am on is Venus, and now it is my world. My arrival was not the only mystery. I am a man of 45 and in good shape, and I'd like to think of sound mind. But good as I felt at that age, I felt even better here on this warm, damp, tree-covered world. I would soon discover there was an even greater mystery I could not uncover. But I will come to that, even if I will not arrive at a true explanation. I pulled off my clothes, which were caked with mud, and shook them out. I had lost both my shoes when the ship went down. They had been sucked off me by the ocean's waters with the same enthusiasm as a kid sucking a peppermint stick. I stood naked with my clothes under my arm, my body covered in mud, my hair matted with it. I must have looked pretty foolish, but there I was with my muddy clothes and nowhere to go. I glanced back at the muddy lake, saw the great lizard and his lunch were gone. The muddy lake out in the center appeared to boil. My guess was it was hot in the middle, warm at the edges. My host, the thing that had brought me here, had fortunately chosen one of the warm areas for me to surface. I picked a wide path between the trees and took to the trail. It was shadowy on the path. I supposed it had been made by animals, and from the prints, some of them very large. Had I gone too far off the path, I could easily have waded into darkness. There was little to no brush beneath the trees because there wasn't enough sunlight to feed them. Unusual birds and indefinable critters flittered and leaped about in the trees and raced across my trail. I walked on for some time with no plans, no shoes, my clothes tucked neatly under my arm like a pet dog. Now, if you think I was baffled, you are quite correct. For a while I tried to figure out what had nabbed me under the waters and taken me through the whirling light and left me almost out of the mud, then disappeared. No answers presented themselves, and I let it go and set my thoughts to survival. I can do that. I have a practical streak. One of the most practical things was I was still alive, wherever I was. I had survived in the wilderness before, had gone up in the Rocky Mountains in the dead of winter with nothing but a rifle, a knife, and a small bag of possible. I had survived, come down in the spring with beaver and fox furs to sell. I figured I could do that. I could make it here as well, though later on I will confess to an occasional doubt. I had had some close calls before, including a run-in with Wyatt Earp that almost turned ugly, a run-in with Johnny Ringo that left him dead under a tree, and a few things not worth mentioning. But this world made all of those adventures look mild. Wandering in among those trees, my belly began to gnaw, and I figured I'd best find something I could eat. So I began looking about. Up in the trees near where I stood, There were great balls of purple fruit and birds about my size, multicolored and feathered, with beaks like daggers. They were pecking at those fruits. I figured, if they could eat them, so could I. My next order of business was to shinny up one of those trees and lay hold of my next meal. I put my clothes under it, the trunk of which was as big around as a locomotive, grabbed a low-hanging limb, and scuttled up to where I could see a hanging fruit about the size of a buffalo's head. It proved an easy climb, because the limbs were so broad and so plentiful. The birds above me noticed my arrival, but ignored me. I crawled out on the limb, bearing my chosen meal, got hold of it, and yanked it loose, nearly sending myself off the limb in the process. It would have been a good and hard fall, but I'd like to think all that soft earth down there, padded with loam, leaves, and rot, would have given me a soft landing. I got my back against the tree trunk, took hold of the fruit, and tried to bite into it. It was as hard as leather. I looked about. There was a small, broken limb jutting out above me. I stood on my perch, lifted the fruit, and slammed it into where the limb was broke off. It stuck there, like a fat tick with a knife through it. Juice started gushing out of the fruit. I lifted my face below it and let the nectar flood into my mouth and splash over me. It was somewhat sour and tangy in taste, but I was convinced that if it didn't poison me, I wouldn't die of hunger. I tugged on the fruit until it ripped apart. Inside, it was pithy and good to eat. I scooped it out with my hands and filled up on it. I had just finished my repast, when above me I heard a noise, and when I looked up, what I saw was to me the most amazing sight yet in this wild new world. Silver. A bird. But no, it was a kind of flying sled. I heard it before I saw it, a hum like a giant bee, and when I looked up, the sunlight glinted off it, blinding me for a moment. When I looked back, the sled tore through the trees, spun about, and came to light with a smack in the fork of a massive limb. It was at an angle. I could see there were seats on the sled, and there were people in the seats, and there was a kind of shield of glass at the front of the craft. The occupants were all black of hair and yellow of skin, but my amazement at this was nothing compared to what amazed me next. Another craft, similar in nature, came shining into view. It glided to a stop, gentle and swift, like a gas-filled balloon. It floated in the air next to the limb where the other had come to a stop. It was directed by a man sitting in an open seat who was, like those in the other machine, a man with yellow skin and black hair. Another man, similar in appearance, sat behind him. His biggest distinction, a large blue-green half-moon jewel on a chain, hung around his neck. This fellow leaped to his feet, revealing himself nude other than for the sword harness and the medallion, drew a thin sword strapped across his back, dropped down on the other craft, and started hacking at the driver, who barely staggered to his feet in time to defend himself. The warrior's swords clanged together. The other two occupants of the wrecked craft had climbed out of the wells of their seats with drawn swords and were about to come to their comrades' aid when something even more fantastic occurred. Flapping down from the sky were a half-dozen winged men carrying swords and battle axes. Except for the harness that would serve to hold their weapons and a small, hard leather-looking pouch, they, like the others, were without clothes. Their eyes were somewhat to the side of their heads. There were beak-like growths jutting from their faces, and their skin was milk-white, and instead of hair, were feathers. The colors of the feathers were varied. Their targets were the yellow men in the shiny machine on the tremendous tree limb. It became clear then that the man with the necklace, though obviously not of the winged breed, was no doubt on their side. He skillfully dueled with the driver of the limb-beached craft, parried deftly, then, with a shout, ran his sword through his opponent's chest. The mortally wounded warrior dropped his weapon and fell backward off his full sword, collapsed across the fore of his vessel. The two warriors in league with the dead man were fighting valiantly, but the numbers against them were overwhelming. The man with the medallion or amulet stood on the fore of the craft, straddling the carcass of his keel, and it was then that I got a clear view of his face. It has been said, and normally I believe it, that you can't judge someone by his appearance. But I tell you that I have never seen anyone with such an evil countenance as this man. It wasn't that his features were all that unusual, but there was an air about him that projected pure villainy. It was as if there was another person inside of him, one black of heart and devious of mind, and it seemed that spectral person was trying to pressure itself to the surface. I have never before or since had that feeling about anyone, not even Comanche and Apache warriors who had tried to kill me during my service with the Buffalo Soldiers. It was then that one of the two defenders, having driven back a winged warrior he had been dueling with, pulled with his free hand a pistol. It was a crude-looking thing, reminiscent of an old flintlock. He raised the pistol in the direction of his adversary and fired. The pistol's bark was like the cough of a tubercular man. The winged man spouted blood, dropped his sword, brought both hands to his face, then relaxed and fell, diving headfirst like a dart. As the winged man dove between the limbs near me, crashed through some leaves, and plummeted to the ground, the sword he dropped stuck conveniently in the limb before me. I took hold of it, thinking that now I had a weapon for self-defense, and that it was a good time to depart. I told myself that this fight, whatever it was about, was not my fight. They were so busy with one another, I had not even been seen. So, of course, casting aside common sense, I decided I had to get into the thick of it. It might well have been the fact that the men in the craft were outnumbered, but I must admit that one glance at the man with the jeweled medallion, and I knew where my sentiments lay. I know how that sounds, but I assure you, had you seen his face, you would have felt exactly the same way. Why I thought one more sword might make a difference, considering the horde of winged men assisting the evil-faced man was enormous, I can't explain to you. But with a thin, light sword in my teeth, I began to climb upward to aid them. This is when I realized certain things. Certain abilities that I had sensed upon arrival, but were now proving to be true. I felt strong, agile, not only as I might have felt 20 years earlier, but in a manner I had never experienced. I moved easily, squirrel-like is what I thought, and in no time I reached the craft caught in the fork of the limb. The winged men were fluttering about the two survivors like flies on spilled molasses. The man with the necklace had paused to watch, no longer feeling the need to engage. He observed as his birds flapped and cawed and swung their weapons at his own kind. It was then that he saw me, rising up over the lip of the limb, finding my feet. I removed the sword from my teeth and sprang forward with a stabbing motion, piercing the heart of one of the winged attackers. It fluttered, twisted, and fell. The yellow-skinned couple glanced at me, but accepted my help without question or protest for obvious reasons. I must have been a sight, naked, having left my clothes at the base of the great tree. My skin and hair matted with mud. I looked like a wild man. And it was at that moment I noticed something I should have noticed right off. But the positioning and the leaves and smaller limbs of the tree had blocked my complete view. One of the yellowskins was a woman, She was lean and long, and her hair was in a rough cut, as if someone had just gathered it up in a wad and chopped it off with a knife at her shoulders. She was not nude, as her opponents were. She wore, as did her companion, a sort of black skirt and a light covering of black leather breast armor. She had a delicate but unquestionably feminine shape. When I saw her face, I almost forgot what I was doing. Her bright green almond-shaped eyes sucked me into them. I was so nearly lost in them that a winged man with an axe nearly took my head off. I ducked the axe swing, lunged forward, stretching my leg way out, thrusting with my sword, sticking him in the gut. When I pulled my sword back, his guts spilled out along with a gush of blood. As he fell out of view, more of the things came down from the sky and buzzed around us, beating their wings. They were plenty, but it was soon obvious our skills with weapons were superior to theirs. They used the swords and axes crudely. They handled them with less skill than a child with a mop and a broom. My partners, such as they were well versed in the use of the blade, as was I, having learned swordsmanship from an older man while I was among the Buffalo soldiers. My teacher was a black man like me, and had once lived in France. There he had been trained well in the use of the steel, and I, in turn, had learned this skill from him. So it was not surprising that in short order we had killed most of our attackers and sent the others soaring away in fear. The necklace-wearing man, who had been observing, now joined in, attempting to take me out of the fray, and I engaged him. He was good with the sword, quick, but I was quicker and more skilled, blessed with whatever strange abilities this world gave me. He caused me a moment's trouble, but it only took me a few parries to grasp his method, which was not too unlike my own. A high and low attack, a way of using the eyes to mislead the opponent. I was gradually getting the better of him when his driver coasted his machine next to the limb. My opponent gave out a wild cry, came at me with a surge of renewed energy, driving me back slightly. Then he wheeled, leaped onto his machine, and slid quickly into his seat, smooth as a woman slipping sleek fingers into a calfskin glove. The sled with the two yellow men in it darted away. I turned, lowered my blood-stained blade, and looked at those whose side I had joined. The woman spoke, and her words, though simple, hit me like a train. She said, "Thank you." It was another side effect of my arrival here. I was not only stronger and more agile, I could understand a language I had never heard before. As soon as the words left her mouth, they translated in my head. It was so immediate, it was as if their language were my native tongue. "You're welcome," I said. This seemed a trite thing to say. Me standing there on a limb holding a sword, mud-covered and naked, with my business hanging out. But I was even more astonished to have my words understood by her without any true awareness that I was speaking my own language. "Who are you?" the woman asked. "Jack Davis," I said, "formerly of the United States Buffalo Soldiers." "The United States?" she asked. "It's a bit hard to explain." "You are covered in mud," the man said, sheathing his sword. "You are correct," I said. I decided to keep it simple. "I fell into a mud lake." The man grinned. "That must have took some doing." "I consider myself a man of special talents," I said. The young woman turned her head in a curious fashion, glanced down at me. "Is your skin black, or is it painted?" I realized what part of me she was studying. Under all that mud, had I been Irish and not part Negro, my blush would have been as bright as the sinking sun. Before long, it would become obvious to me that on this world nudity was not something shameful or indecent in their minds. Clothes for them were ornaments, or were designed to protect them from the weather, but they were not bothered by the sight of the flesh. "Correct," I said. "I am black. Very much so." "We have heard of black men," she said, "but we have never seen them." "There are others like me," I said. "We have heard that this is so," said the woman, "in the far south, though I suspect they are less muddy." "Again," said the man, "we thank you. We were very much outnumbered, and your sword was appreciated." "You seem to be doing well without me, but I was glad to help," I said. "You flatter us," he said. "I am Devel, and this is my sister, Jarell." I nodded at them. By this time, Devel had turned to the sled and to the dead man lying on its front, bleeding. He bent down and touched his face. "Bandel is dead by Tordo's hand, the traitor." "I'm sorry," I said. "He was a warrior, and there is nothing else to say," said Jarell. But she and Devel, despite their matter-of-fact tone, were obviously hurt and moved. That's why what happened next was so surprising. Devel dragged the corpse to the edge of the sled, then the limb, and without ceremony, flipped it over the side. "To the soil again," he said. This seemed more than unusual and disrespectful, but I was later to learn this is their custom. When one of their number dies, and since they live in high cities and populate the trees, this is a common method. If they die on the ground, they are left where they fell. This treatment was considered an honor. I processed this slowly, but kept my composure. My survival might depend on it. I said, "May I ask who these men were and why they were trying to kill you?" Jarell glanced at Devel, said, "He chose to help us without question. He is bonded to us in blood." "True," Devel said, but I could tell he wasn't convinced. Jarell, however, decided to speak. "They are the Varnan, and we are warriors of Sheldon. Prince and princess, actually. We are going to their country in pursuit of the talisman." "You're warring over a trinket?" I said. "It is far more than a trinket," she said, "and since there are only us two, it is hardly a war." "I would call in reinforcements," she nodded, "if there were time, but there is not." She did not elaborate. We left it at that for the time being, and set about releasing the silver craft from the limbs where it had lodged. This seemed like a precarious job to me, but I helped them do it. The craft proved light as air. When it came loose of the limbs, it didn't fall, but began to hum and float. Devel climbed into the front seat position where the dead man had been, touched a silver rod, and the machine hummed louder than before. Jarell climbed into one of the seats behind him, said, "Come with us." Devel glanced at her. "We can't leave him," she said. "He looks to be lost." "You have no idea," I said. "And he helped us when we needed it," she said. "He risked his life." "We have our mission," he said. "We will find a safe place for him," she said. "We still have a long distance to go. We cannot just abandon him." This discussion had gone on as if I were not standing there. I said, "I would appreciate your taking me somewhere other than this tree." Devel nodded, but I could tell he wasn't entirely convinced. I stepped into the machine, took a seat. Devel looked back at me. I could tell this was a development he was not fond of, in spite of the fact I had taken their side in the fight. But he said nothing. He turned forward, touched the rod. The machine growled softly, glided away through a cluster of leaves and limbs. I ducked so as not to be struck by them. When I looked up, the machine had risen high in the sky, above the tree line, up into the sunny blue. I was astonished. It was such a delicate and agile craft, so far ahead of what we had achieved back home. This made me consider that, interestingly enough, their understanding of firearms was far behind ours. There was a part of me that felt that it would be nice if it stayed that way. It seemed humans and birdmen were quite capable of doing enough damage with swords and axes. As for the pistol Duvel had fired, he had discarded it as if it had been nothing more than a worn-out handkerchief. I glanced over the side, saw below all manner of creatures. There were huge, leather-winged monsters flying beneath us and in the clear areas between the trees. On the ground in the rare open spaces, I could see monstrous lizards of assorted colors. The beasts looked up at the sound of our humming machine, their mouths falling open as if in surprise, revealing great rows of massive teeth. We passed over hot, muddy lakes boiling and churning with heat. Huge snakes slithered through the mud and onto the land and into the trees. It was beautiful and frightening. In a short time, I had survived the sinking of a great ocean liner, an uncommon arrival in a hot mud lake, climbed a tree to eat, found a fight against a yellow man with a strange talisman who was assisted by winged creatures and had taken sides in the fight. Now, here I was, lost and confused, flying above massive trees in a feather-like craft at tremendous speed. My body feeling more amazing than ever, as if someone had split open my skin and stuck a 20-year-old inside me. It made my head spin. "Exactly where are you going?" I had to raise my voice to be heard above the wind. "Perhaps it is best we do not speak of it," Duvel said. "You aided us, but our mission is personal. You know what you know about the talisman, and need know no more." "Understood. But where are you taking me?" "I am uncertain," Duvel said. "Very well," I said, not wishing to be put out of the craft and left to my own devices. I needed to try to stay with them as long as I could to learn more about this world. Here was better than wandering the forest below. How much better off remained to be seen. As an old sergeant told me around a wad of chewing tobacco once, "If you ain't dead, you're living, and that's a good thing." It was one of the few bits of advice he had given me I had taken to heart, as he was always jealous of my education, which he called white man's talk. I had been blessed with a Cherokee mother who had learned reading and writing in white man's schools and had become a teacher. She always said education didn't belong to anyone other than the one who was willing to take it. She also said education was more than words and marks on paper. She taught me the customs of the Cherokee, taught me tracking, about living in the wild, all the things I might need to survive. That said, I preferred the comfort of the flying sled to the rawness of the wild world below. This way, I had time to consider and plan, though I must admit, my considerations and planning were not accomplishing a lot. It was more as if wheels were spinning inside my head, but wouldn't gain traction. Besides, let me be entirely honest. The woman was why I wanted to remain. I was smitten. Those green eyes were like cool pools, and I wanted to dive right into them. I wanted to believe there had been some kind of connection on her part. But considering my current appearance, the only person or thing that might love me was a hog that had mistaken me for a puddle to wallow in. I can't say how long we flew, but I feel certain it was hours. I know that exhaustion claimed me after a while, the cool wind blowing against me, me snug in my seat. I might have felt better and stronger, but I had swum in the cold ocean, pulled myself from a hot mud pit, climbed a great tree, and fought a great fight. So I was tired. I drifted asleep for a while. When I awoke, the sun had dipped low in the sky, and so had we. We were coasting down between large gaps in the great trees. We came to trees so huge they would have dwarfed the redwoods of home. There was even one with shadowy gaps in it, the size of small caves. That's when I saw that nearly all the trees had large gaps in them, from head to foot. It was part of their natural construct. As the sun finally set, we flew into one of those tight wooden caverns. Devel parked his airship, and we stepped out. The night was dark as in the inside of a hole. No moon was visible. What stars there were made a thin light. But then, as I stood there looking out of the gap, soaking in the night, an amazing thing happened. It was as if there was suddenly dust in the air, and the dust glowed. I was confused for a moment. Then some of the dust landed on me. It wasn't dust at all, but little bugs that were as silver as the flying sled, shinier. The entire night was filled with them. They gave a glow to everything, bright as the missing moonlight. I should pause here and jump ahead with something I later learned. There was no moonlight because there was no moon. This world was without one. Of all the things I had trouble getting used to, that was the one that most pained me. No bright coin of light coasting along in the night sky. In place of it were glowing insects, lovely in their own way, but they could not replace in my mind the moon that circled Earth. Jarrell pulled a length of dark cloth from inside a container in the craft, fastened it to the top and bottom of our cavern. It stuck to where she put it, without button or brace or tack or spike. The cloth was the same color as the tree we were in. I realized immediately that at night and perhaps in day at a decent distance, it would appear to be a solid part of the tree. We were concealed. There were cloaks inside the craft's container, red and thick. Jarrell gave Devel one. Me one, took one for herself. She turned on a small lamp inside the craft. The source of its power, I assumed, was some kind of storage battery. It lit up the interior of our cavern quite comfortably. Jarrell broke out some foodstuffs, and though I couldn't identify what she gave me except for a container of water, I lit into that chow like it was my last meal. For all I knew, it was. It wasn't good, but it wasn't bad either. Before long, Devel lay down and pulled his cloak over him and fell asleep. I was near that point myself, but I could tell Jarrell wanted to talk, that she was interested in me. She began with a few simple questions, most of which I couldn't answer. I told her about the great ocean liner and what had happened to me, how I thought I might be in a dream. She assured me she was real and not a dream. When she laughed a little, the way she laughed, sweet and musical, it assured me my ears were hearing a real voice and that my eyes were seeing a strange and rare beauty. Jarrell tried her best to explain to me where I was. She called the world she knew Zunzin. She took a slate from the craft with a marker, drew a crude drawing of the sun, then placed her planet two places from it. I knew enough basic astronomy to know she was talking about the planet we called Venus. I learned there was only one language on Zunzin, and everyone spoke it, with varying degrees of accent according to region. I told her about the moon I missed, and she laughed, saying such a thing seemed odd to her, and it was impossible for her to grasp what it was I so sorely missed. After a time, she opened the back of the sled and took out a large container of water. She also found a cloth and gave that to me to clean up with. I was nervous wiping myself down in front of her, but as she seemed disinterested, I went about it. Running water through my hair and fingers, wiping myself as clean as possible with what was provided. When I was nearly finished, I caught her eye appraising me. She was more interested than I had first thought. I don't know why, but Jarell took me into her confidence. Had Devel been awake, I don't know she would have. But I could tell she trusted me. It was an immediate bond. I have heard of and read of such things, but never believed them until then. Love at first sight was always a romantic writer's foolishness to me, but now I saw the idea in an entirely new light, even if it was the light from a battery. Tordo has taken our half of the talisman, she said. The other half is in the city of the Birdmen. Once it was whole, and its powers gave the Birdmen a great advantage against us. Our people warred constantly against them. We had no real land to call our own. We moved among the trees, for we couldn't defend ourselves well in a direct fight against the Birdmen, not with them having both halves of the talisman and aided by wings. Where does it come from? I said. What does it do? I can only speak of legend. The halves have been separated a long time. One half was with our people, the other with theirs. It is said that in the far past, the two tribes, weary of war, divided the talisman. This was not something the Birdmen had to do as they were winning the conflict, and we would not have lasted. But their warrior king, Darat, felt we could live together. Against the advice of his council, he gave our people one half of the talisman and kept the other. Divided, it is powerless. United, it was a dangerous tool of war. No one remembers how it was made or of what it was made, or even what powers it possesses. When Darat died, the tradition of peace carried on for many years with new rulers, but then the recent king of the Birdmen, Conrad, was of a different mind. After many generations, he wanted the lost power back. And one of your people, Tordo, betrayed you, I said. Jarell nodded. He was a priest. It was his job to protect our half of the talisman. It was kept in a house of worship. You worship half of a talisman? Not the talisman, the peace it gives us. Peace from the Birdmen, anyway. There are others who war against us, but they are less powerful. The Birdmen could be a true threat. It surprises me that Conrad has taken this approach. The peace between us had worked for so long. What we are trying to do is stop Tordo before he delivers our half of the talisman. My father, King Ron, sent us. We did not want to alarm our people. We thought to overtake the thief swiftly, as we got news of his treachery immediately, Tordo's and that of the lesser priest, the one who was with him in the flyer. But it turned out Tordo was prepared for our pursuit. His actions hadn't been of the moment, but were long prepared. He had the winged men waiting, an assistance given him by King Conrad. Tordo knows how my father thinks, knew he would try to catch him with as little alarm as possible by using a small force. He knew this because Tordo is my father's brother, our uncle. Betrayed by family, I said. There isn't much worse. We could go back and raise an army, but it would be too late. 2 days and he will be in the city of the Varnin, and they will have both pieces of the talisman and all of its power. Seems to me that being the case, you should have flown all night. Jarrell grimaced. You may be telling the truth about being from another world. You doubt me? I asked. She smiled, and it was brighter than the light from the battery. I melted like butter on a hot skillet. Let me show you why we do not fly at night, why no one in his right mind does. She took hold of the cloth she had placed over the entrance to the tree cave, tugged it loose at one edge, said, "Come look." I looked, and what I saw astonished me. The sky was bright with the glowing insects, thicker than before. Their light showed me the sky was also full of great bat-like creatures, swooping this way and that. They were the size of Conestoga wagons, but moved more lightly than the flying sled. They were snapping and devouring the shiny bugs in large bites, gulping thousands at a time. Fly at night. They will make sure you do not fly for long. We call them night wings. They rule the sky from solid dark until first light. Then they go away, far beyond the trees and into the mountains where they dwell. This means your uncle has to stop for the night as well, I said. Exactly, she said. When the night wings depart in the early morning, we will start out again, hope to catch up with them. They don't have a tremendous lead, but it's lead enough if they are able to arrive at the city of the Varnin and my uncle delivers the talisman. Were you and your uncle ever close? Close, she said? No. He was not close to my father. He felt he should have his place of rule. My guess is he hopes to do just that under the agreement of Conrad of Varnin. He would rather rule with a cloud over his head than not rule at all. I would like to assist you. I have a good sword arm. I can help you stop your uncle. I pledge my allegiance to you. Jarrell grinned when I said that. I accept, she said, but Devel must accept as well. That sounds good to me, I said. For now, let us rest. We took our cloaks, stretched out on the floor of our wooden cave. I tried to sleep, and I thought I would have no trouble, exhausted as I was. But I merely dozed. Then I would awake, thinking I was fighting the waters of the great Atlantic, only to find I was indeed on Venus, sleeping in a tree. And sleeping not far away was the most beautiful and enticing woman I had ever known. I was up when Jarrell and Devel rose. It was partially dark, but some light was creeping through the cloth over the gap in the tree. Jarrell pulled it loose, let the beginnings of early morning seep in. Jarrell and Devel moved to an area of our cave away from me and whispered. As they did, Devel would glance at me from time to time. His face was a mixture of emotions. None of them appeared to be amused. After a moment, Devel came to me, said, "Jarrell trusts you. I feel I must. Her judgment is generally sound." "I assure you," I said, "I am trustworthy." "Words are easy, but you will have your chance to prove your loyalty," he said. "Don't let us down." "Did I let you down in the fight?" "No. But what we face from here on out will be much worse. It will try all of us." "Then put me to the test," I said. We flew away from the tree and into the morning sky. As we went, the sun grew large and the sky grew bright. The glowing bugs were long gone to wherever they go, some in the gullets of the night flyers, and the hungry bat things were gone as well. We sailed on into the bright light, and before long, it was less bright, and the clouds above were dark and plump with rain. Finally, the rain came, and it came hard and fast, and began to flood the seats on the craft. Devel guided our flying sled down and under the lower limbs of the trees. We dodged in between them swiftly, and close to limbs that for a moment looked like inevitable crash sites. But he avoided them. flicked us through clusters of leaves, then down under a series of trees that were smaller in height than the others, yet wide and numerous of branch with leaves so thick the rain could hardly get through. It was as if a great umbrella had been thrown over us. As we went, the sky darkened more, and the rain hammered the trees and shook the leaves. Random drops seeped through. Then came the lightning, sizzling across the sky with great gongs of thunder. There was a great crack and a flash, a hum of electricity, and a monstrous limb fell from one of the trees. The lightning, as if seeking us out for dodging the rain, flicked down through a gap in the larger trees and hit one of the smaller ones just before we glided under it. A spot on the limb burst into a great ball of flame, and there was an explosion of wood. It struck the front of the craft, hit so hard it was as if a great hand had taken hold of the front of the flying machine and flung it to the ground. Fortunately, we were not flying high at the time, but it was still a vicious drop. Had it not been for the centuries' buildup of loam from leaves and needles and rotting fruit to cushion our fall, we would have burst apart like a tossed china cup. We smacked the ground hard enough to rattle our teeth. The machine skidded through the loam like a plow breaking a field. It went along like that for a great distance beneath the trees, then hit something solid that caused us to veer hard left and wreck against the trunk of one of the smaller trees. It was such an impact that for a long moment I was dazed. When I gathered my thoughts and put them into some reasonable shape of understanding, I examined my surroundings. I was in the middle seat of the flying sled, Devel ahead of me, Jarell behind. But she wasn't. She was missing. I struggled out of my seat, got up close to Devel. He wasn't moving. He couldn't. He was dead. A short limb jutting out from the tree had been driven securely through his chest, bursting his heart. His body was painted in blood. I fell off the crumpled craft, landed on the ground, and started to crawl. When I got enough strength back to manage my feet under me, I searched around for Jarell, screamed her name. "Here," she said. I turned, saw her rising up from behind a pile of leaves and branches. She was scratched up, but from where I stood, she looked well enough, all things considered. When I got to her, she surprised me by taking me into her arms, clutching me to her. "Devel?" she asked. I gently freed myself from her embrace, shook my head. She made a squeaking noise and fell to her knees. I squatted beside her, held her as she shook and cried. As if to mock us, the sky grew light and the rain stopped. The world took on a pleasant emerald glow.